These days, Vietnam is often regarded as a bit of a holiday destination. Well, as we'll hopefully work our way through the next 40 or so minutes, we'll see some of the ways in which maybe the roots of the cultural conflict and elements that occurred within Vietnam really kind of trace back to the 15 years following World War II. But just to remind you in terms of the previous elements of this particular module, last week we were considering the angry young men, those young poets who were clearly concerned about something. I'm not quite sure what they're concerned about, but whether it was losing touch with their roots, whether it was the over dominance of American culture and so on, or whether it was something just as simple as actually seeing the establishment of coffee bars becoming established in the capital of the country in the 1950s in terms of Soho and the elements that relates to that. In any sense, the angry young men, as we named them, pretty much rejected American influences. Okay? Now, they weren't alone in that, but equally, there were many people who were quite happy to have American influences, much as we might say is the case today. But the argument that was put together to object to transatlantic influences was very much the notion of American consumer culture undermining British values. And this is something we'll keep coming back to in terms of seeing how Britishness is perceived, how it's developed, and so on. And also the sense that British culture itself would disappear under the pressure of this great thing that we call American consumerism. This notion that everything would be fine as long as you actually bought stuff. Also the throwaway culture, the kind of the onset of doesn't matter if you simply wear out your shoes or various other things, you just get new ones, constantly getting new ones, new, etc., new, newest, the best. It's always synonymous. New is best, and best is new. But actually, you've got a problem to start off with in terms of that criticism, because in many ways, those angry young men were pretty much products of the American influence that they would criticise. It's difficult when you're that close into a situation to really start saying, oh, hang on, we've got a problem here, we've got issues to work with this, within this whole field. So let's spend a little bit of time considering why this whole cultural notion of advertising and mass marketing was very much coming to the fore within the 1950s. Well, you can roll back the clock to the onset of the social sciences. Social sciences, in other words, economics, psychology, sociology, political science, really emerged in the 1930s. What the social sciences were all about, and if you've done A-levels in one of those particular subjects, you might well be aware of this, is very much the notion of research and statistics. In other words, finding out data about human beings. And these social sciences, which again emerged, as we said, in terms of the 1930s, were primarily designed to really provide information for two groups of society. First of all, politicians, because there is a sense that politicians want to know how to counter the worst economic and social effects, certainly in America, of the Great Depression. And also the burgeoning growth in advertising. If you know who you're marketing to, you know what their wants and desires and needs actually are, it's more easy for you to sell them things. And from the political point of view, if you can also find out how society works, that wonderful nebulous thing which we all kind of have a sense of what it's all about. We all know, if I ask everyone in this room, what do we mean by society, you'd probably be able to come up with some kind of definition. But it's not necessarily a precise one. But there is still this sense that society can be changed by making minor adjustments. In current terms, we actually have the nudge theory. It's no good trying to get people to give up sugar immediately. You've got to kind of nudge them into a healthier lifestyle by demonstrating that actually there are ways in which you can actually reduce your calorific intake and so on and so forth. It's a slow, gradual process that you're working for. If you can make those adjustments, as the name science suggests, you can also predict and control outcomes, like the general election, or Brexit, or pollsters, and so on. And clearly the results of those in recent years have suggested that maybe in terms of social sciences, even that isn't precise enough to give you a general indication of where society is actually going. Because let's not beat about the bush. Knowledge is power. If you have information that you can apply to something before it actually hits the fan, be that a war situation, a prospective war situation, a terrorist situation, and so on, you're pretty much on the road to kind of getting a discovery, some notion as to how to react and how to develop and so on. In other words, there was this general feeling that somehow the appliance of science and technology and public policy planning would actually change everything for the better. After all, what was the most recent application of science that had really led to huge changes in society? Well, it was the Industrial Revolution, in terms of the ways in which the steam engine, James Watt, and the onset of electricity, and the telegraph had all kind of coalesced over a period of 50, 60, 70 years to really change society, and arguably some might say for the better, although again, it is predicated on that notion of arguably. Is your life better when you have a fridge? Well, it means you can keep stuff more than you could if you actually just had a pantry, perhaps. Is it better with the washing machine? Is it better with all of these white goods? Well, clearly, if you're in the business of manufacturing white goods, which from the 1920s and 1930s, most of the industrialisation was kind of geared to that and automobiles and so on, clearly you wanted to actually see that your producers were happy. So the manufacturers of everything from motor cars to refrigerators would be employing psychologists to check on their workers' morale. The sense being that a happy worker would be a productive worker. An unhappy worker will not be putting their heart and soul into producing the material that you want them to produce. There were issues of time and motion studies that would be developed. How can you predict the ways in which systems are operating? The concept of Fordism, named after Henry Ford, creator obviously of the Model T. You can have any colour as long as black. Mass production was in vogue. Actually, from the European perspective, not only had there been a revolution in Russia, but there was also the onset in 1920 of Karel Čapek's play Robots, R.U.R., Rossum's Universal Robots. And this is the first time that robot is actually coined as an automaton that simply does work almost mindlessly. Again, this science, the way that things actually develop and so on. Testing characters, psychometrics, the notion that you want the right fit of your employee with your employer, all designed to get the best results needed to organise workers, to control the workers, and to ensure the quality of the products that the workers produce. Win-win. Great ideas, which by the time of the 1950s were beginning to percolate across the Atlantic Ocean. And so by the 1950s, there was a greater demand in Britain for new university courses which looked at these social sciences. And if you didn't know after the arts in university, if you were heading into university, you'd been to grammar school and so on, he also found that there were a greater number of middle-class students who would be learning new skills and training for jobs in planning, town planning. Remember, lots of towns being built at this particular time, so lots of need for town planners, architects, surveyors, and so on. There were jobs in adult education, jobs in public policy, social services, and so on. So actually, if you did a degree in the social sciences, psychology, sociology, etc., you were kind of almost heading towards a vocational pathway. That actually created the new generation of young British graduates in the 50s and early 60s who would not only read the novels of Kingsley Amis, view the plays and movies of John Osborne, but they'd listen to jazz, they'd go to the cinema, they'd watch new wave films, and so on. So into that whole mix, you also get this notion of consumerism. Now, by the beginning of the 20th century, American industry was already thriving. By the middle, the dream was there. Although, again, as this slide points out, or illustrates quite clearly, it's a dream which is restricted to a particular ethnic sphere of society, namely white middle-class male. They're in the car, with a nice friendly family dog, 2.4 children. There's no way like the American way, except if you're not white, except if you're etc., etc. So again, it's not as though there's a specific paradise for all here. But the fact of the matter was that by the middle of the 20th century, American factories were pouring out goods, the stock market was soaring, and credit was easy to come by. Companies would promote what it was they wanted to sell through advertising campaigns, which actually very effectively used the techniques of war propaganda. It's interesting that propaganda that emerged from the First World War, when people realised that actually untruths were being told by both sides, was actually synthesised and developed and refined and evolved into the kind of advertising culture and the advertising mantra of what's the need, let's identify the problem, let's show you how we can fix and solve that problem. There were a range of labour-saving and luxury goods which would actually hit the general public. Telephones, vacuum cleaners, washing machines and cars, all very much to the fore. And in addition to that, as if it wasn't enough to already have these adverts coming out, don't you? The whole notion of American films and advertising campaigns would carry images primarily of the American way of life. At least, as I said, for the idealised middle classes all over the world. So it was a global perspective. Lenin actually said if he could have controlled Hollywood, he would in essence have kind of converted the world to communism within about 5 years. Eisenstein didn't quite sort of live up to that side of things. And middle-class Americans would actually come to consider their standard of living a right. This right to liberty and happiness would also be added to with the right to consume. The centre of the corporate world was shifting from Wall Street to Madison Avenue. The whole notion of the Mad Men of the recent TV series. People who actually lived and worked in Madison Avenue in New York who were churning out campaigns, advertising, slogans, and so on. Overall, this was to lead to the aim of democratic capitalism being perceived, in which there was a fairer distribution, in which, in the main, the American dream was predicated on the notion that everyone can have a car, everyone can have a home, everyone can have a fridge, and so everyone will be happier. Companies working for building materials and the construction industry clearly were benefiting from this, because the more that the American dream was actually fueled in popular magazines like Life and Better Homes and Gardens, the more likely it was going to be that they were called upon to actually build things and stuff as well. And this ideal family was very much promoted. There were happy parents, which meant there would be happy children. The family life of the television, the patio, the barbecue, family vacations, the car, the appliances, the fashion, the safe neighbourhoods, heating, air conditioning, all part and parcel of this whole package. And also, energy is very cheap. You can fill up your car for, you know, literally pennies or cents. Of course, by the mid-1950s, the Middle East had started putting up oil prices. Remember the question of Suez. America also was beginning to spend so much on defence that even though she was getting a lot of income from the capitalism at home and exporting goods overseas and the support that they actually got through loaning countries like Britain help during the Second World War, they were still actually concerned about their financial products. And so it became increasingly important to export this American model of democratic consumption. In other words, exporting American goods to the rest of the world if the American economy itself wasn't going to collapse. And so by the 1950s, the influx of American ideas and American goods was inevitably beginning to change the look of Britain. This was because, as we've said, America needed to do it. It needed to export, it needed to sell its goods. Otherwise, it wasn't going to make enough money to actually cover its own bases. Particularly when you're in the middle of a Cold War and you've got to actually watch out for those deadly Soviets and so on. Coffee bars, Coca-Cola, jukeboxes, American music, American movies, and American fashions would all flood the market in the 1950s. returning back to that notion that critics of that particular influx would argue, just as French critics actually have often done. But again, people have said that the reason France has been slightly more successful in maintaining its culture is because, obviously, they don't speak American. We in Britain speak American English. And if you don't think we speak American English, because obviously we don't spell colour C-O-L-O-R. You just look at how much you consume in terms of what comes through from the movies, from the TV shows, from the Netflix series, and so on and so forth. This notion that American culture was destroying British culture again relates to the notion of people watching American films, listening to American music. In other words, as Hoggart said last week, losing touch with their own past and identity. In that sort of Richard Hoggart novel, Uses of Literacy. So a situation is there whereby American values are seen on one level as destroying British values, destroying the notion of family and community, living within your means, effectively not overspending, not actually looking to have the constant new factor. And also this sense that actually you would purchase happiness, whatever that might be, by buying a new fridge or by engaging in a new fashion. In other words, you look at the surface as opposed to looking within, looking for a deeper personal happiness. Result, people were shallow, people were dissatisfied. If you didn't have the latest fashions, you weren't keeping up with the trends, you weren't in with the in crowd. And yet, on one level, the right to consume, it's argued, is not what life should be about. As we'd said, the American aim was exporting capitalism. It was exporting democratic consumerism to the rest of the world. We'll talk about this in seminars. That may or may not be a good model. But there was a genuine belief within the American state, the United States of America at the time, that they were exporting the best type of society and giving the world the right to participate in the American way of life. It's ironic that, again, you have the other extreme of communism, which also believes similar kinds of things. However, if America is going to prosper, Europe and Asia needed to be on board so that global markets could develop. Problem. There we see it. Major problem with respect to the ideological period of the time. Not everyone accepts that model of American consumerism, that right to consume. The Soviet Union, the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics, came up with a competing socioeconomic model, which of course is communism. Communists believed that production should be owned and controlled by the state. So it's not shipped out to private enterprise. It's not the person who effectively has the biggest pockets who wins. It's actually made a legislative part of the state system. Society should be classless. It shouldn't be based on consumption. It should be based on people's individual needs. So far, so wonderful, you might well say. Except for the challenge, of course, in trying to enforce that particular brand of equality. Because the question, as George Orwell sort of wrote in his concluding section to Animal Farm, is that all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. We've been through an interesting geopolitical system here, insofar as the evils of fascism, loaded term admittedly, but fascism in general, had been sorted out by the Second World War. Hitler, Mussolini, Franco were still in power in Spain, but generally fascism had burnt itself out. And the partners, of course, in burning that fascism and sorting it out were the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin in particular. Part of the responsibility of Stalin post-war was to very much start dividing Europe, the whole setup of the Iron Curtain, as Churchill defined it, coming down and descending. Equally, China had also had a communist revolution. And communists, like Americans, wanted a world that was modelled on their own system. Human beings sometimes couldn't be like that. We don't want to actually sort of import somebody else's system. We want our own system. And this particular satirical line from 1960 very much sees the concern of the time. Uncle Sam, that wonderful symbol of all that's good and that's emerged in the latter part of the 19th century in terms of America and friendliness and so on, into the 20th century, where America is very much the number one country in the world, sailing along quite happily, and yet you have countries that are now mere tombstones. Poland, Hungary, North Korea, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, China. And like all icebergs, the old line, 9/10 of the iceberg is under the surface. This is 50 years, well, 48 years after Titanic has obviously collapsed on its iceberg, so the metaphor is very much to the fore. The consequence of that fear, and fear it was, is the Cold War. Now, I've already said that up to a point, the Soviet Union, or Russia, and Britain, and America were all pals, fighting against the evils of Nazism in the Second World War. But then it begins to become an ideological shift. For a large period of time, well, a large period of time, everything's relative, 5 or 6 years or thereabouts, America still has the upper hand because clearly America is the only country that has the atom bomb, which is a fairly significant weapon to display if required. But, and this is a very important proviso, even when Russia and the Soviet Union actually have the atomic nuclear capability, it's never in either side's interest to go to war. Because what would you be left with? A burnt out husk of a planet. In other words, mutually assured destruction. Allowing for the fact that it's never in the interests of either side to go to war once they had nuclear technology, the next best thing, if you like, is an ideological war. A war which consists of saber-rattling. A war which consists of propaganda. You can't fight a war directly, as we've mentioned, but both sides can get involved in what would be called proxy wars, such as the Korean War in 1950 and 1953. 2 million civilian casualties, 500,000 casualties among the Allies in the South, and those casualties included United States, British, Canadian, and Australian troops. In North Korea, apparently there were 1.5 million casualties, including Chinese troops and Soviet advisers. Again, it's very misleading in terms of the figures for North Korea, because clearly North Korea, since the establishment of the 39th parallel, has effectively gone into deep isolation, coming out only once to march in the Winter Olympics this year, which is nice. Let's say, I don't know. The Korean War, as I say, came to a partial end, because after 3 years, again, people had felt that it wasn't necessarily the case that they wanted to go to war over this, and certainly it was very much one in which the Chinese advisors would be advising people in North Korea, and the Americans in South Korea would be effectively sort of battling against that. But from the 1950s throughout the 1960s, and indeed arguably up to the 70s and 80s, the Cold War became a way of life. There was East versus West, there was communism versus capitalism. The main areas for ideological and military intervention, in other words, these proxy wars between different superpowers, were areas that we now refer to as the Third World countries. Countries where old empires were beginning to crumble. There was a fear that with those European empires crumbling, not just British, also the French Empire as well, effectively there was a fear that the Soviets would take over. And one of those countries was the French country of Indochina, which is now better known as Vietnam. Indochina actually accompanied Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. It was very much a part of the French global expansionism, and it's one of the reasons why French is the dominant language which was spoken there for a number of years. During the Second World War, the Japanese actually marched in and occupied Indochina. And by the time the Japanese actually left, a revolutionary movement began to spring up, with Vietnam very much taking the lead, and the lead was basically enough of people marching in and taking over our way of life. We've had it with the French, then the Japanese, never again. So as far as the Vietnamese were actually concerned, they wanted to end colonial control, and they wanted to seek a new life for the population. Now, France, you might argue this is an interesting one, given that they'd been occupied twice in two world wars, or then you could argue maybe they learned from the experts, decided they weren't having any of this, and they wanted to actually try and regain the colony. But learning from the huge catastrophe that Suez was, in terms of embarrassment and so on, first of all, they sought backing from the United States. And, possibly to the French people's surprise, the United States says, yes, we want to back you. We want to actually support you. We can't get involved directly, but we can actually support you in terms of trying to win back your former colonies. Why? Because they were afraid of that. What is referred to as the domino effect. This theory states, as we see demonstrated visually there, that if one country falls to communism, China, for instance, which had already gone, North Korea had already gone, oh no, that might mean Vietnam might go, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, and before you know where you've got it, where you are, pretty much all of Asia has become communist. Not wanting to buy American goods, actively rejecting American goods, rejecting any Western culture whatsoever, and basically telling us all to go forth and be fruitful. The other problem with respect to that is, okay, maybe they don't want to buy the latest hamburger or the latest Ford automobile or Chrysler motor or so on. Interestingly, I was in Crewe last Tuesday, actually visiting one of my students who's on a work placement there, and it's extraordinary that the biggest market for Bentley automobiles, apart from the United Arab Emirates, is still China. It's seen as a status symbol, having a £250,000 Bentley that's been handcrafted. Interesting. But if you want to sell things to people, in addition to that, you might also want an exchange. And Indochina is also rich in rice, it's rich in rubber, it's rich in coal, it's rich in iron ore. It's got all of these kind of things there, as well as being a gateway to markets and commodities in Southeast Asia. So any loss of these countries would massively threaten and impact American interests. So what was the result? America began to funnel in billions of dollars to bolster the French. And when the French decided that they'd had enough, they pulled out and put in their own puppet government in Saigon to actually look after the whole process under a gentleman called Diem. Now, Diem, D-I-E-M, was fairly unpopular because America hadn't really thought through their foreign policy. That's a surprise. They placed a Catholic in Diem in charge of a country that was predominantly Buddhist. They placed somebody in charge who basically was primarily pro the landlords and not the peasants. Again, you've got this Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, finding out information, deciding what is the best way forward. You also put somebody in place who actively imprisons anybody who criticises him. Oh, he could almost have been a 1950s version of Saddam Hussein. In terms of that, you clearly get a resentment, a massive resentment. And communists in the north of Vietnam gathered around Hanoi as the centre of government, led by the gentleman you can see there who took over North Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh. In 1960, rebels in the south under American control formed the National Liberation Front, which they called the Viet Cong. Now, what else is happening in 1960? Well, there was that sign that we saw a few weeks ago where Harold Macmillan was looking at the future being pointed to, etc. Yes, there was a new president who had been elected to the United States. John F. Kennedy was in place and in position. And his view was very much to support both Diem, the imposed Vietnamese leader, as well as actually taking on board the whole notion of American involvement in the region. Now, on one level, here you have a situation whereby the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were taking on the greatest military superpower in the world. It was like Lincoln City playing Chelsea under-21s. We would only have one outcome, possibly. But inevitably, as we said, the Vietnamese had a long history of challenging occupation. Not only the Japanese and the French, but before that, actually the Chinese were very much occupiers of the whole French Indochina area. So this notion of the little guy challenging the major aggressor becomes part of a national cult. And Diem doesn't cope with any dissidents to his pro-America regime. Indeed, in June 1963, you see there a Buddhist monk sat down in public square in Saigon and set alight to himself, immolating himself simply as a protest. Others would follow his example, and Diem would arrest people, he'd lose temples, he'd fire on protesters. All of this is not good publicity. It's not good public relations. Especially when the CIA are desperately working subversively in a country to support a military coup by the generals. By this time, and before Kennedy's assassinated, there are approximately 17,000 unofficial CIA advisors working in Vietnam. 17,000. They've realised that Diem is an embarrassment. He's got to go. Again, shades of Saddam Hussein later on in the century. But in the end, not one of those advisors decided to warn Diem about the coup that was planned by his own generals, despite the fact that Diem eventually started panicking and there were various urgent telephone calls in which he was asking for help, and Diem was eventually found dead in the back of a truck. 3 weeks after that, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and the new vice president, Lyndon Johnson, took over. Well, he's got a nice thing to actually follow in all sorts of other areas. Now, LBJ, or Lyndon B. Johnson, never really expected to be taking over the presidency of the United States, because John F. Kennedy was the dynamic, bright young individual who was bringing the new Camelot to the world, who was effectively going to be in place until, of course, that fateful trip to Dallas, which saw him effectively reach the end of his tenure in a most dramatic and unfortunate way. And Lyndon B. Johnson was an inexperienced man. He kind of was looking to cope, but there was a general sense at the time, again, this is post-Bay of Pigs, post-Cuban Missile Crisis, Vietnam is beginning to escalate now, that actually things are getting out of control. To continue the football analogy, possibly he didn't know what he was doing. Defense Secretary, sitting next to him there, Robert McNamara, was also a new man, but McNamara was an educated social scientist. So there was still this sense from McNamara's background that if you could actually just tweak society a little, adjust it in some way, then actually these were solvable problems. In 1965, America started a full-scale war in Vietnam. Result? Disaster. By 1968, there were 500,000 American troops in Vietnam, all fighting a fairly dirty guerrilla war. America actually dropped more bombs in Vietnam than both sides in World War II, and they spread chemicals to destroy forest cover. The average age of the soldier conscripted to serve in Vietnam, as Paul Hardcastle once sang about, 19. There were things such as napalm jelly that were being used. Napalm is a gasoline jelly. It sticks to people when it lands on them and it burns them alive. The army would go after dissidents in search and destroy missions, where it's clear civilians who may or may not support the Viet Cong and nationalism would be killed together with guerrillas, and they'd be taken away to refugee camps. So again, very much it's a case of the scorched earth policy is at work here, and we can't use nuclear bombs, but we can damn well make sure we use everything else in place to actually keep the natives in check and so on. Obviously, our G.I. Joes happily seen there, chasing children away as well. Operation Phoenix was what the CIA actually entitled one of their operations, and Operation Phoenix actually resulted in the execution of 20,000 civilians without any trial at all because they'd been suspected of communism. So a bit more dramatic than the McCarthy witch hunts had actually been in the 1950s. This was a mass execution. Not quite genocide, but still fairly significant. And in 1968, in My Lai, a detachment of Americans on search and destroy missions killed 450 to 500 women, children, and the elderly. They would line them up in a ditch. They would shoot them. In other words, there was a line that war was pretty much driving people crazy. Now, this war carried on until 1973. And inevitably, it was a disaster in most senses. It was a disaster from a military perspective, because America got bogged down in an environment that they weren't used to fighting in a very hot, tropical climate, with problems in every sense of the word from that point of view. It wasn't like fighting in Europe. It wasn't like fighting in other previous wars where they could march in and ride out as cavalry being victorious. It also cost $100 billion. So much for saving funds then. Perhaps most significantly, it also undermined America's self-belief. Arguably, it's never really recovered from Vietnam. And there were 58,000 American soldiers killed, with 3 to 4 million Vietnamese also killed. So great place to have a holiday these days. The war inevitably had a huge impact on the American psyche because of television. This was a war that was being beamed into their living room screens time and time again. They would watch TV reports of body bags bringing home their soldiers, their sons and daughters, as the war unfolded on television. And clearly, at no stage in the equation was that the American dream that they'd been promised. Young men would increasingly take that attitude. It's quite rightly so. They'd refuse to register for the draft, or they'd burn their draft cards in protest. And in San Francisco, 300 young men returned their cards in an anti-government protest. By mid-1968, there were over 3,000 prosecutions of people who refused to be drafted, and 1 year later that had gone up to 34,000. Again, that whole sense of patriotism, doing your duty for the country, serving the draft, working through that. One of the interesting debates that still takes place is, why didn't Harold Wilson's government support or send soldiers to support the Vietnam War? Because obviously we had done so in North Korea. And there are lots of tales coming out from the CIA attempting to influence Wilson, from sensing that he was under Soviet advice and so on. Maybe it was just because, thankfully, he'd realised that obviously since national service had actually come to an end in 1963, they could actually ease back on the fact that they didn't have to send people off to be killed in warfare. Inevitably, though, going from 300 to 34,000 is going to have impacts. And there are lots of peaceful protests that start developing. The hippie movement develops very much as a result of this. And in 1967, there was a huge Pentagon demonstration. Pentagon, of course, is the main powerhouse of American governmental army militaristic power. Anti-war protesters would develop, the brainchild of Abby Hoffman, who we see there as the co-founder of the Youth International Party, or as they refer to, the Yippies, as opposed to the Hippies. Part of it, you might say, was fairly eccentric. There was an attempt by the Yippies to actually levitate the Pentagon using thought waves alone. But at the same time, it was a peaceful demonstration. Unfortunately, that peaceful demonstration, as you might imagine, in a decade which saw the assassinations of John F. Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Martin Luther King, was going to have impacts. The kind of people who were protesting weren't just students and social activists. Primarily by early 1968, ordinary people had actually become very anxious about the whole process. Muhammad Ali, the boxer, refused to serve, and authorities actually took away his boxing championship title. In other words, what this war was doing was destroying a belief in authority. And equally, in Britain, we are seeing the televisual images of this beamed across on our screens on a nightly basis as well. As we'll see, this also impacts in terms of other people not only rejecting American capitalism, but also rejecting the whole notions of the American war in Vietnam per se. So, war, in this case the Vietnamese War, was destroying this belief in authority. Millions of young people would reject the values and behaviour of their elders. Students and young workers would all take part in this whole notion, which had a clearly connected line of clothing, of language, of sexual behaviour, of drugs and so on. As the Harvard scientist Timothy Leary said, it was time to turn on, tune in and drop out. So by 1968, the foundations of American society are very much under threat. things are going from bad to worse in Vietnam. Martin Luther King, whilst campaigning against poverty, is assassinated, which leads to the huge outbreak of urban violence in the ghettos, which again was put down by soldiers. Robert Kennedy was assassinated as well shortly afterwards, as a presidential nomination was sought on an anti-war platform. In August, thousands of anti-war demonstrators, August 1968 that is, thousands of anti-war demonstrators descended on Chicago for the Democrat Convention, and the city police assaulted marchers in what was later called a police riot. Hundreds were injured. And in 1969, the great counterculture festival that was Woodstock established itself. It also became a national emergency because roads were blocked and so many people were actually looking to get to not only demonstrate against the war but also to engage in peace, love, harmony and so on. Lyndon B. Johnson had been voted out of office in 1968 and the president who took over from him was another in that long line of wonderful, successful, great leaders of the USA, Richard Nixon. And Nixon's view was very much on the line of, well, okay, we haven't had much success in Vietnam, let's invade Cambodia, which he did in 1970. Now, this was basically too much for many liberal academics at the time, and indeed students. And at Kent State University in Ohio, there was a peace protest against Cambodia's place in the world, and also the invasion of Cambodia, which resulted in the National Guardsmen firing into the crowd, injuring 9, paralysing 1, and killing 4 students. The photo we see here is of Mary Ann Vecchio, V-E-C-C-H-I-O, Mary Ann Vecchio, who was actually a 14-year-old runaway, who was kneeling over the dead body of Jeffrey Miller. Again, these are not the kind of images you want to see celebrating the American way of life. This is the American nightmare, not the American dream. Something is clearly fundamentally wrong with a society where you've actually got these issues brought to the fore. And the publicity that was given to student protests created the impression that actually the opposition was mostly also middle-class intellectual folk, but many blue-collar workers were opposed to the troubles as well. And by 1970, opinion polls, obviously emerging out of social sciences, showed that there were 65% against the war. Vietnam as a phenomenon produced opposition by soldiers and vets, army vets, etc., veteran soldiers, on a scale never seen before. There were thousands of desertions. People, frankly, were sick to the back teeth of this war that they didn't understand. They were being sent to die in whether it's Vietnam or Cambodia and so on, for images there of 4 students who effectively were killed in the Kent State massacre. Being probably slightly younger than yourself, or same age or thereabouts. Soldiers in Vietnam actually started wearing armbands and badges supporting the peace movement. Again, not great for morale. So morale amongst the soldiers was very low. There were 209 incidents of fragging in 1970. Fragging, in American US Army talk, is where you actually roll a fragmentation bomb under the tent of a superior officer. Oops, not very good. And in addition to that, the hippies, as a protest movement, were seen very much as a predominantly American phenomenon, but one whose attitudes and fashions quickly spread to Europe. A Europe which, of course, had only just come out of a massive conflagration 20 years earlier, in 1945. So by the time we get to 65, 67, 68, and so on, you're seeing a generation who don't really want to repeat the same mistakes that their former generation folk, their parents had actually had. And so if there was a way of engaging with attitudes and fashion that wasn't simply taking on board the consumerism, but actually taking on board the rebelliousness of the hippie movement, saying you didn't actually want to buy stuff, you could actually exist without buying those whole systems, maybe that was something else that looked to be exploited and developed as well. By the late 1960s, Vietnam, ironically, like everything American, became an international issue. There was a binding together of groups of protesters in many countries, across Europe, in Britain, and so on. And there was the beginning of spreading countercultural ideas about racial equality, about alleviating poverty, about maybe having a world in which peace was being looked at as something to be treasured and worked for, as opposed to seen as a time in between wars and so on, in which sexual freedom was also being developed, as well as freedom and equality within the sexes, as well as drugs and music, the flip side to the coin. And the impact of the Vietnam War, together with other cultural impacts, will be the subject of our first session after Reading Week. But we'll be talking a bit more about Vietnam and others who saw End the War in Indochina, Vietnam Now, in our seminars in about 10 minutes from now, or on Thursday. Thanks for your time. And make sure that you've signed the register, which will be out there somewhere.